Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Manning.
Welcome back to the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's China in the World podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome an old friend and an old Army colleague, formerly Colonel David Shin, now Dr. David Shin, to discuss his new book, Kim Jong-un's Strategy for Survival, A Method to Madness. Dr. Shin's book presents a fascinating account of North Korean defense strategy under Kim Jong-un, questions some of the widely held assumptions about North Korean strategic intentions and the risks of conflict on the Korean Peninsula. And before we delve into the contents of the book and discuss other North Korean related issues with Dave, I want to first introduce him. Dr. David Shin is currently an associate professor and the deputy chair in the Department of Regional Security and Intelligence Issues at the College of Strategic Intelligence, National Intelligence University, NIU. Dave served over 25 years in the U.S. Military Intelligence Corps in the U.S. Army, and he served as a Northeast Asia Foreign Area Officer, retiring in 2011 as a colonel. I had the opportunity to work with Dave as a military intelligence officer in the Republic of Korea. And then we went to the Joint Military Attaché School as we were both heading out to be assistant Army attachés. I was in Beijing and Dave was on his way to Korea. Dave holds a PhD from Cranfield University Defense Academy of the United Kingdom and master's degrees from the then Defense Intelligence College, now NIU, where he's working, the University of Washington, and the then Industrial College of the Armed Forces, now called the Eisenhower School at the National Defense University. Dave graduated with his bachelor's degree from Virginia Military Institute in 1986. In addition to the book that he just published, which I mentioned, he's also the author of another book called Rationality in the North Korean Regime, Understanding the Kim's Strategy of Provocation, which was published in 2018. His latest book came out late last year, 2020. Dave, it's great to have you on the podcast. Great to be reconnected after our Army days, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Paul, first of all, I'd like to thank you and the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book, Kim Jong-un's Strategy for Survival. But that said, I need to first state my disclaimer before we continue this talk.
Absolutely.
It says, all statements of fact, analysis, or opinion are my own and do not reflect the official policy or position of the National Intelligence University, the Department of Defense, or any of its components or the U.S. government. Now I'm ready.
Great. I'm glad you did that. We do not want to get you in trouble here on the China in the World podcast. Dave, your new book looks at Kim Jong-un's strategy for survival, including his consolidation of power at home, his international strategy, in particular, international strategy with regard to relations with China, Russia, South Korea, and the United States. Similar to your previous book, The Rationality in the North Korean Regime, 2018 book, which I mentioned, and I would also recommend to our listeners. The new book, again, questions widely held assumptions about Kim Jong-un's defense policy and diplomacy. And you, in the book, I think you present a new way of thinking about the North Korean leader's brinksmanship and bluster, a bit outside of the conventional wisdom. The publication of your new book, of course, is quite timely. Given major shifts in international politics, we have a new administration in the United States, Japan, and potentially we will have a new administration in South Korea in 2022. So before diving into the contents of your book, I thought our listeners might be interested to hear about your background. I've mentioned a lot of it in the bio, but, you know, personally, how did you get to begin working on Northeast Asian security issues and what are you working on now?
I was initially going to Germany for my first assignment, and someone talked me out of that. And for my first tour, I ended up in Korea. And that's when I got hooked on Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asia issues, primarily because I realized how much I didn't know. And I was very fortunate that the Army gave me an opportunity after company command, where we served together in the 501st MI Brigade, 93-94 for me. And after that tour, I was able to go and do my foreign area officer training, beginning at the University of Washington, where I met some of my mentors, some of who have passed on. But that's where I began to seriously study Korean Peninsula issues and worked North Korea several times while I was on Peninsula and while I was on the joint staff twice. So that's how I got interested in the book and ended up writing the first one and this one. So I'll get to, you know, why I wrote this book, in part because of my long-term experience observing North Korea, both on Peninsula and off. And I began to see a lot of people commenting on what happened in 2017 between former President Trump and Kim Jong-un. And some even claim that, you know, we were on the verge of not just conventional war, but nuclear war. And I remember thinking back way back in 94 at the field station, where we said something very similar about the collapse of the regime. Something was going to happen. And that was in July of 1994, right after Kim Il-sung passed on. And of course, that didn't happen. So in any case, I began to question this rationale for, you know, brink of nuclear war, and began to research.
You and I were there, Dave, at the same time when
Kim Il-sung
passed away. And I remember during that time, there's quite a bit of uncertainty, and there were some threats from the North Korean side, and that they were going to turn South Korea into a sea of fire. And those of us that served during that time talked about the sea of fire tour in Korea at the time. It's, you know, your description of, you know, how you became interested in these issues and decided to dive deep is, it, you know, very much parallels my own background. My first assignment was Germany. But then I went to Korea shortly after. When I was in Germany, of course, the wall fell and, you know, geopolitical situation was changing. And I really got struck by international affairs and being based in Korea, I traveled to China and just thought this is fascinating. And like you, wanted to dive deeper. And you went to the University of Washington. You know, I clearly, your story really resonates with me. And those early assignments are so important in the Army. It sparks off an interest in you, and then you kind of run with it. And it sounds like that's what happened to you. In with regard to your book, Dave, why don't you just, if you would, give a kind of an overview or summary of the book and the primary themes that you cover, and, you know, what the main arguments are that you wanted to convey.
First, focused on the four cases under Kim Jong-un, and that was the first, what I call the first nuclear crisis in 2013, when he deployed a mobile missile system that he claimed could target the United States. Many people at the time did not believe that. And the second case was the August 2015 landmine incident. And the next two are the ones that I'm going to cover in detail. And that's what happened in 2017 and mm-hmm. the Charm Offensive that was launched in 2018. But part one of the book I had to write in part because of some discussion about madman theory that people began to used to describe what former President Trump was doing. And also because of this idea that the Kims, arguably all three of them, at least at the beginning of their reign, were often underestimated and sometimes called crazy, a lot of other derogatory descriptions of them. Mm-hmm. Then I talked about how Kim Jong-un, the third son, ascended to power. And finally, one of the chapters I covered was about North Korean style of totalitarianism. And I ended with a discussion about the policy implications, which I will discuss when I talk about the new Biden administration's North Korea policy.
Well, that sounds, I mean, it's a great way to divide it up. And I think if you don't mind, I think, we have covered on this podcast, we've had Chinese experts, we've had American experts, Korean experts come on during the 2017 nuclear crisis. And the charm offensive that you mentioned, which followed with the 2018 Winter Olympics in Korea. And let's focus on those two time periods, if we could, because our listeners can then tie it back to other podcasts that we've published. As you mentioned, 2017, I remember it being a very volatile period in U.S.-North Korea relations. I mean, they're always pretty volatile. This one was particularly volatile, both President Trump and Kim Jong-un exchanged the personal criticisms and barbs, Trump over Twitter and Kim Jong-un through the official North Korean press outlets. At one point, I believe it was in August of 2017, I remember North Korea threatening to attack the U.S. naval base in Guam. And President Trump, of course, threatening to rain fire and fury down on North Korea. You know, at the time, a lot of commentators thought the sequence of events was unprecedented and perhaps a prelude to potential nuclear war. What is your understanding of what happened during the nuclear crisis? How did you lay it out in your book?
Yeah, so first, I'd like to kind of briefly discuss, my method of analysis after laying out what happened. So a lot of people talk about, strategy, Kim's strategy, North Korea's strategy. But often they don't explicitly say what they mean by that. So in the introductory chapter, I kind of discuss various perspectives about strategy and ended up coming up with seven questions about Kim Jong-un's strategy. And the first one is, basically his understanding of the situation, no matter what situation that you're looking at, what case that you're looking at. And then try to figure out what the central element of his design, strategy design is, and what he has to do to achieve success. Mm-hmm. Then of course, what objectives is he trying to achieve to get the outcomes that he desires? And then the fourth one is about resources. What resources does he have at the time that he wants to use and actually does use? And the fifth one is something that Joe Nye mentions when he talks about the smart power concept, is that no matter what strategy that you have, you normally have an information campaign to justify what you're doing. And I think that's an important part of understanding what the Kims do, because of messaging from North Korean state media outlets, which many ignore as just simple propaganda. And then the sixth one is this idea of assessing the probability of success of your strategy. Mm-hmm. So if you think that it's not going to work, you're not going to do it. You'll have to modify and adjust and make improvements. Mm-hmm. And the final one is who supports your strategy and who opposes it, to simply put. Using that framework, I looked at what happened in 2017. That was the first case that I want to talk to you about. And I didn't realize how important the South Korean disclosure in late August 2015 was regarding the Op Plan 5015, which many began to characterize, including the North Koreans, as a decapitation operation. So based on that understanding, and eventually over the next few months moving into 2016, other outlets, including CNN, talked about how the North Koreans eventually used their hackers to get the op plan from the South Koreans. So they had an understanding of the plan, and I think they including Kim, were threatened by this. And that's what I argue, that because of that plan, he began to accelerate his missile testing in 2016. They were mostly failures, but I claim in the book, and others have too, that you can learn a lot from failures. And it was evident when he was launching missiles, including ICBMs, in 2017, that they had fixed a lot of the problems that they were having in 2016. The other thing is that I don't think he, and I think many other people, didn't really know what former President Trump might do with respect to North Korea. So they were putting out feelers, mostly with conservative North Korea experts, but I don't think they were very cooperative. But that fact came out also later in 2017, that they were trying to do this in January, right after President Trump took office. So that kind of gives you a sense of this need to understand your adversary, right? So they were actively pursuing different means to understand what President Trump was doing. Ultimately, I argue that because many commentators, to include Krauthammer, he argued that that Trump might be using Nixon's and Kissinger's man-made theory. And he was, at that time, he was arguing that he appeared to be fairly successful in getting results. For example, forcing our allies in Europe to invest more in defense. And when I began to do some research on this, many people began to say that President Trump was doing this, using this strategy. You know, basically, he was messaging that he was unpredictable. He was crazy enough to do almost anything to get what he wanted. But the North Koreans, I think, eventually figured out President Trump. And I make the case by saying that in early November, in one of their newspapers, they basically called out what they call the MAD strategy. And it's basically talking about their understanding of the man-man strategy, man-man theory. And they basically said that many presidents have used it before, to include Trump. And if you fall for it, you know, you're going to lose. And they were not going to fall for it. So they called them out. And that's when, several weeks later, they launched the Hwasong-15 ICBM, which they claimed could reach all of the continental United States. And many observers from the outside confirmed that what they were saying was credible based on what they observed. So that's another important thing, to argue that what they were doing was real, right? So they had an information campaign, and they included lots of photos of all the things that Kim was doing in 2016 and 2017. And I think the other factor that was really important was the fact that former President Park Geun-hye was impeached in December 2016. And they began to see that current President Moon Jae-in, he might actually win the presidency in the summer of 2017. That also, I think, was in Kim's calculus, because he realized that if he could successfully test and convince others, particularly those, you know, not just people in North Korea, but also those in the outside world, that he actually had a viable nuclear ICBM, he could pursue a charm offensive when South Korea held their Winter Olympics in February 2018. Without Moon there, that would have never happened.
Yeah.
So that's the gist of the argument that I talk about when I talk about the design of the strategy.
Well, you've made some really important points. And I mean, first and foremost, you know, the questions you lay out about understanding the North Korean approach, very logical and structured analytical framework. Not surprising as a former military intelligence officer that you would use that, but very thorough and comprehensive. And your point about the op plan, the decapitation op plan, causing the North Koreans to feel threatened or exposed. And, you know, we hear this from the Chinese. You know, when I participated in the six-party talks as the White House rep, Chinese would emphasize over and over again that ultimately the Chinese believe that the key problem that we need to solve is the North Koreans' feeling of being unsecure, that they need a security assurances. They need to know that, and you know, we've tried that in certain ways, but it's sort of never, you know, been accepted by the North. And I think they're feeling that they need to get this nuclear program to a certain level, to a certain capability, so that they have, as you called it, a viable deterrent. And it's quite something, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of missile tests in
2016,
you know, very unprecedented, a rapid sort of pace, making a lot of mistakes, as you talked about. You can learn a lot from failure. But ultimately, at the end of the 2017, that Hwasong 15 ICBM test, and then the North Koreans came out shortly after saying they now have a viable deterrent, which allowed them to shift to 2018. Which was quite different than 2017. Rather than, you know, threatening to strike U.S. military bases, Kim Jong-un went on this, as you call it, this diplomatic charm offensive. He met with leaders of South Korea, China. That was a big surprise to a lot of folks, Russia, and of course, the United States. And President Trump and Kim Jong-un met for the first time in June of 2018 in Singapore, and then a second meeting, which wasn't very successful, in Hanoi in February 2019. Although at the end, you know, the Trump administration was not able to reach a final agreement on denuclearization. And you've already sort of given an indication that, in your view, the North Koreans, you know, they weren't going to fall for the bluff that, you know, the madman theory. And we saw a little of this in other foreign policy issues, including, I would argue, the trade negotiations between the U.S. and China. At the end of the day, the Chinese pulled back from some of their most important commitments because at the end of the day, they didn't feel that U.S. had much leverage outside the tariffs. And so in a sense, I think, you know, Trump's bluff was called there too. But what was your assessment of Kim Jong-un's charm offensive in early 2018? And in particular, I'd like to know, you know, how serious was he about the key issue that we're really focused on, of denuclearization?
Yeah. So when I was thinking about what was happening in 2017, looking towards 2018, and this is, you know, before the flurry of summitry that occurred beginning with Kim and Xi Jinping in China, I was thinking that the focus was going to be, you know, targeted to South Korea only. As I was thinking about writing the book, and I wrote another piece for another venue that argued that, you know, some people think it was all about maximum pressure that brought Kim. And I argued that there was a strategy behind it all. And it wasn't really maximum pressure that forced him to come to the table. But that's the, you know, the debate that I had with somebody. Regarding, you know, what happened, right, with Kim coming back to negotiations. Essentially, what I was arguing was that I talked briefly about how the impeachment of Park Geun-hye and the election of Moon in May of 2017 was critical in the design as he pressed on testing. But ultimately, I think he was looking at perfecting the ICBM capability before the end of the year so he can try to get into the Winter Olympics in 2018 in South Korea. So he was able to do that. Of course, I don't think many people expected his sisters to go there. And by and large, he was very well received in South Korea and set the stage for everything that came. And then, of course, Kim began to look to China first. Then he had his meeting with President Moon in Panmunjom in early 2018. And you can kind of get a sense of, you know, this momentum building. It was almost like South Korea and North Korea, Moon and Kim, were kind of working together to make all this happen. And Kim took the time to consult and inform Xi Jinping. And not sure what the perspective is in China, but I'm also guessing that Xi Jinping probably gave him some guidance and advice as well, as he had met with President Trump before. But in any case, the primary actors from the North Korean point of view, of course, was the diplomats at this point, and of course, the two Kims. And I think they did a fairly good job of normalizing themselves, the Kim family, and also the North Korean regime. In the end, you might say, all of this was really for gaining access to President Trump for a number of reasons, you know, legitimacy for one, but also perhaps to gain sanctions relief, right? So ultimately, it came down to that in Hanoi in February 2019, and we know it didn't happen. Many observers have pointed this out, but I think it's worth emphasizing that I think you can argue, as soon as they had the summit in June of 2018 in Singapore, the Trump administration, began to relax their maximum pressure, right? They were lauded for what they were doing with maximum pressure. Many people argue that it was working. And I said before, some argued that that's what got him to the table. But once he began to relax the maximum pressure and began to build a relationship, some have called it a bromance between the two, ultimately, even after the failures in Hanoi, you know, North Korea offered the facility at Yongbyon. I assume that it included the 2,000 plus centrifuges that were there that Dr. Hecker saw in November of 2010, right? But in any case, we walked away and we thought that was the right move. I think most people said that was the right move at the time. That wasn't enough. We wanted more. But the reality is, after that, we stopped designating, I think it was hardly any more designations of any North Korean entities or people with respect to sanctioning them. So whatever we had, we held, and we claimed to have, you know, maintained the maximum pressure campaign. But in reality, the gloves are off, and we didn't really want to pressure the North Korean regime as much as we did under the maximum pressure campaign when it started. And that means Kim had a lot more room to maneuver. Yes, it's not the same thing as, you know, getting all the sanctions lifted that was levied in 2016 because of all the missile testing. And then what happened in 2017, actually they did nuclear tests in 2016. They also did another nuclear test along with the ICBM launches in 2017. But that's why all these sanctions were levied against them. And of course, they didn't get them off. But because not many people, not many countries were willing to apply the same level of pressure, he was able to get away with a lot, right? And you can kind of get a sense that Kim was able to recover. Things were getting back to normal. And that's when the COVID situation hit. And things have changed a lot as a result. So by looking at these two cases, you can learn a lot about Kim, his regime, how he makes his decisions, and even, you know, taking a look at, you know, some of the things that perhaps we could have done, depending on how you assess, for example, you know, our stated goal of completely denuclearizing North Korea. Yeah. I think most people have said, you know, that's not realistic for a number of reasons. You know, you've been involved in this process it's very hard to completely verify and make, you know, everything that we're doing irreversible in North Korea with respect to their nuclear programs. That would mean that we would be, you know, allowed to visit any facility that we suspect is a nuclear facility or a related facility, which is never going to happen. So CVID was never in the cards, I don't think. And that is why in 2005, in September, we simply agreed to the language that says they would abandon, you know, the nuclear and related programs, and not, you know, do CVID. So in any case, I think you can kind of get a sense of, you know, the Kims understanding their environment. Mm-hmm. And when they think there's a probability of success, they will engage. Yeah. So in the second case that I just talked about, the charm offensive, you can argue they didn't get what they wanted. If the ultimate aim was sanctions relief officially from the U.S., they didn't get it. But I argued in the book that they got informal sanctions relief, and that was almost as good. Not many people were in with this plan to levy maximum pressure on the regime anymore. That included the U.S., frankly.
Yeah.
So I think Kim was sitting pretty at the time, although he wasn't completely satisfied with how things turned out.
I think you're right. I mean, the maximum pressure campaign sort of, you know, let off a lot of steam, in part because once we were in diplomacy, I think China, also South Korea, felt that there should be some sanctions relief, that the North Koreans should get something for entering the negotiations. And I think the U.S. had a very different position there. But as a result, I think the Chinese were not, you know, as serious and robust in their efforts. And, you know, I think it sort of let off the pressure, no doubt about it. And in terms of legitimacy, clearly Kim Jong-un got quite a bit of international recognition by meeting with President Trump. You know, as to the argument about, you know, if I understand you correctly, you know, I argued at the time that the maximum pressure campaign was helpful, but it was not the reason that Kim Jong-un shifted to diplomacy, that he was on his own timetable. And I think that's what you're arguing, that he had a strategy to, you know, get that Hwasong-15 ICBM tested, the one that can reach continental United States, and, you know, to have that basic level of nuclear deterrence. Once he had that, then he was more confident to enter into diplomacy, and he got that. And as you said, the politics were right at the time, with President Moon having come into office earlier in 2017. So, you know, in a sense, I mean, you know, the Trump administration would often sort of risk breaking their arm by patting themselves on the back about the maximum pressure campaign, but I'm not sure that they give enough sort of attention to what the North Korean strategy was and where were they on their timeline. That was my own sense. And it was also remarkable when President Trump, you know, you mentioned the China piece, and I'll come back to this at the end of our discussion, but, you know, I was in Beijing when President Trump, through the South Koreans, conveyed to the world that he was open to meeting Kim Jong-un face-to-face, one-on-one. And very quickly, the Chinese mobilized. I think they felt as though they were at risk of being isolated and not influential because they'd been part of the maximum pressure campaign. The Chinese leadership had refused to meet with Kim Jong-un up to that point, and were not particularly happy with the North Koreans because Kim Jong-un had really ramped up his missile tests and his nuclear tests, and they didn't like that. But when the risk was there that President Trump could kind of take diplomacy into his own hands without the Chinese there at the table, they moved to correct that very quickly. Xi Jinping met with Kim Jong-un. And you remember, of course, the plane that was used to get Kim Jong-un to Singapore was a Chinese plane with the logo on the side. So, you know, clearly saying, you know, the Chinese got North Korea's back here. And they were back in the game. They were not going to be left outside of the context of this diplomacy, and they moved very quickly to rectify that.
Yeah, so I argue in the book, looking at the Trump offensive, that when I talk about who opposed the North Korean strategy and who supported it, by then, definitely the Chinese, and then you could add the South Koreans to that mix too. So, you know, I'm not sure how the South Korean audience would view this, but it was clear that President Moon was involved in the process of getting definitely the first Trump summit. But I think the goals of the three countries pretty much aligned. And arguably that was stability for Seoul and Beijing, and perhaps even for Pyongyang. But I think you're right. Kim had his own timetable. He had a plan. And as I tried to argue, I think Kim figured him out. You argued that the Chinese might have figured him out as well, that a lot of it was bluster. And then, you know, how do you, you know, come to that conclusion? Well, if you just look at what the U.S. And North Korea was doing, and you can kind of get a sense of heightened tensions and this, you know, looming war that might come, whether it's conventional or nuclear. But if you look at all the actors that are involved, South Korea, China, and eventually even Russia, you can kind of get a sense that it wasn't as bad. And I argue that that's how Kim felt. He was very comfortable that China had his back, and now the president of South Korea, at least in 2018. You could even argue, even now, President Moon's legacy is about his engagement with North Korea and what could come out of that. He only has about a year left, and I think he's going to do a lot to try to make that happen.
Fascinating. Well, your analysis of the events of 2017 and 2018 are really important, and your book provides a lot of important insights into the worldview and the strategic calculus of Kim Jong-un. We've got a new administration, obviously, in the White House under President Biden. You know, this administration is not using tweets to set policy or as a strategic deterrent, which I'm awfully pleased about. But I am curious to hear your thoughts on the Biden administration. And, you know, if you have any advice, you know, based on what you've learned from doing the research into your book, you know, what is your assessment of the Biden administration's initial policy review, which has been coming out in the press? I'm not sure they've officially released it, but we're getting bits and pieces of it. And what insights might the administration be able to draw from your book to help deal with the North Korean issue?
Before I answer the question, I think what I can do is to apply the book's findings to assess what has been disclosed about the Biden administration's policy on North Korea. I've been tracking it. Initially, I looked at all these press reports that came out, whether it was from the White House press secretary or others. But I think what I ended up doing was, because they had the summit on 21 May last Friday, and a joint statement was issued, I argue that reveals quite a bit about where we are and potentially some of the friction points. On the surface, you know, you can say it was a successful summit. And even if you kind of read through what was said, I'm not going to cover everything that was mentioned regarding North Korea and the alliance, or the fact that it was a broader joint statement that looked beyond the Korean Peninsula. And I think that's where the U.S. achieved a lot, right? Getting the South Koreans to get more involved in the Indo-Pacific, and also on global issues like climate change, COVID vaccines. But what I was able to kind of take away from that was the idea that the two sides are committed to global nonproliferation, right? What does that mean? The U.S. not going to recognize North Korea as a nuclear weapon state, mm-hmm. right? So if you do that, you know, it affects the NPT, and others could try to break out. And then it also talks about how you know, both are committed to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Other officials had previously said complete denuclearization of North Korea. I think that's the U.S. perspective. But here in the joint statement, it talks about the Korean Peninsula. And that's what's said in the Singapore Agreement. That's what's said in the Panmunjom Declaration. So I think that's why they settled on the Korean Peninsula. It also talks about, after a policy review, the U.S. will take a, quote, calibrated and practical approach that is open to and will explore diplomacy with North Korea to make tangible progress that increases the security of the U.S. and South Korea. And then you kind of have to think about, you know, what I said in the book is achieving complete denuclearization of North Korea is probably not very realistic. As I said, many people have already said this. But I also argue that unless we're willing to start a war to achieve our non-proliferation goals to denuclearize North Korea, we got to get whatever we can, right? I'm not sure what you sensed when you were in Yongbyon with Ambassador Chris Hill, right, at that facility. I don't know what you were thinking at the time. But I'm guessing that you thought you were making some success, right? So I argued that, you know, what the North Koreans have always said, whether it's action for action or step by step, whatever terminology that they use, should have been accepted, right? Because they're not going to go for a big deal, especially if there are conditions up front, like complete denuclearization first. Then we'll give you everything. That's not going to work. It has never worked. So I was thinking, out of the Hanoi summit, the U.S. should have taken, you know, whatever they were offering at Yongbyon, just to see what the U.S. would get. Why? Well, they wanted a lot of sanctions lifted. It was arguably making an effect on their economy, on the regime. I make that case even now because you can always snap back sanctions. And what has to be made clear is whatever you come to with respect to an agreement, you have to tell everyone, right? If you don't follow through, then these sanctions will be snapped back. And I think if you make that kind of a declaratory statement ahead of time, and then you pursue some kind of an action for action program, I think it's you know, more likely to succeed than not. So we'll have to see what they mean when they say, you know, they're going to have a calibrated and practical approach. So what does that mean? We'll know. You know, we'll see what happens. Who acts first? Is it North Korea? Is it the U.S.? Or is it President Moon? Because he only has a year left. That remains to be seen. The second point is that they also called for full implementation of relevant UN Security Council resolutions. That means like all of them, okay? And then they said, including those applied against North Korea. So sanctions will remain in place. It'll be an important part of the strategy, right? Again, I go back to this idea. When will the U.S. ever consider sanctions relief, right? So is that part of the U.S. calculus when they say calibrated and practical approach? Who knows when, you know, the momentum for negotiations will occur?
Yeah.
Passive just, it might happen during this administration. Every administration since Clinton, there's been some type of negotiation, right? So don't know when, but when that happens, are we willing to pursue action for action? That remains to be seen. I argue in the book, you know, that's probably a approach that should be considered. Yeah. So you're not looking for a grand bargain, big deal, but a small one that moves the process forward. Why? Because we don't trust each other. So I think it's the only way to kind of move things forward. Yeah. Third, what's missing is anything about China being part of this process, right? So I kind of said in the book, it's a pipe dream to think that the Chinese will resolve or help the U.S. resolve the North Korea problem for us. So I think they kind of recognize the same. I think the Trump administration at the beginning thought they can get the Chinese to help. But near the end, they realized that was not going to happen. Yeah. So I think in this sense, the U.S., the current administration is much more realistic about their strategy and how to move forward. So the other thing is, it talked about how important it is to maintain joint military readiness. When I hear that, I'm thinking about military exercises, right? So North Koreans will continue to say that's evidence of U.S. hostile policy toward the regime, and they'll rail against it like they always have. And I think President Moon, depending on, you know, it could happen when, because the U.S. promised to deliver 550,000 COVID vaccines to their active duty soldiers, Marines, airmen, and sailors. When that happens, you know, they can go out there in the field and begin to do field training exercises. Depending on when that happens, August, maybe later, then President Moon might reconsider, you know, how intense that kind of an exercise would be, if at all, depending on what he wants to do with North Korea at the time.
Yeah.
So the U.S. will have to kind of be open to, you know, South Korean requests to perhaps dial down our plan to do exercises. Mm-hmm. Why do I say that? We talked about what happened in the Trump administration, and that included, you know, basically saying military exercises are a waste of money. And we, you know, de-escalated by not doing a lot of exercises other than basically CPXs, command post exercises, right? So I recall in 1994, when I was a company commander at the time, we canceled Team Spirit. We did one in 93. We canceled it in 94 because they were involved in negotiations. It ultimately led to the agreed framework in October 1994. So depending on the situation, if you're pragmatic, you got to do what you got to do to negotiate and get a deal. So I don't think it's too far-fetched to say, you know, have an open mind, see what's being offered, and if necessary, consider what you want to do with military exercises. And the final thing, I think, is the treatment of our allies in South Korea. I think President Trump basically viewed the alliance as, you know, a waste of money. And he wanted South Korea to pay, I think, 400% more in terms of burden sharing, upwards of $5 billion. And it was noted in the joint statement that we have a multi-year agreement. And I think that lasts to like 2025. So it kind of stabilizes the relationship beyond President Moon. And I think that was the right thing to do. I think that the final thing that I would mention is this language about promoting trilateral cooperation between the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. So one of the things that I talk about is the weakening of what some have called the Southern Triangle, right? That is the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. The Northern Triangle being China, Russia, and North Korea. That's being strengthened. And the South, the Southern one, the Southern Triangle is being weakened. So now I think there's some willingness on the South Korean part, perhaps, to do more with Japan. At least the joint statement gives you some hope that the U.S. is trying to reestablish that, and that's a good thing.
Well, that's a great answer. I saw what the Biden team put out as well, and the calibrated and practical approach, step by step, although they don't use that language, but you get the impression that that's what they're talking about, moving away from the Trump notion of a grand bargain, or what I used to call a Hail Mary, really, because didn't think it had a lot of possibility, but Trump was willing to sort of give it a try, throw the ball up and see if his team can catch it, but it didn't work. And so, you know, the idea, you know, saying that, you know, it's going to be difficult to get complete denuclearization along the lines of what you say, comprehensive, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, pretty difficult, maybe impossible, but giving that up as a policy goal has significant implications, as you mentioned, undermining the nonproliferation treaty, potential, you know, arms race, other countries in the region wanting to get nuclear programs themselves. So it's a whole different ballgame in my mind if you kind of say, recognize officially that we can't get the North Koreans to denuclearize and therefore we're going to have to accept it. And I don't think the Biden administration's interested in doing that. And so you didn't see that. You know, as far as this, you know, step-by-step action for action, you asked me what I was thinking, you know, on my, I took, I think, 5 or 6 trips to North Korea during my time in the six-party talks. And what I was, people would ask me when we come back from those trips, you know, will Kim Jong-un give up his nuclear program? And, you know, I think, or will the North Koreans, I guess, Kim Jong-il, I guess what, you know, the way we answered that question at the time was, it's not clear, but it appears as though the North Korean leadership has taken out an option to do so if it determines along the way that the deal that's being presented, you know, gives it enough confidence to do so. So they hadn't made a strategic decision to do so, but they hadn't made a strategic decision not to do so. And we wanted to carry that forward. And so, you know, I think this is a reasonable approach that the Biden administration is announcing. I agree with you that China needs to be part of the process. They're an important piece. We can't outsource it to them. They're not going to solve this, you know, for us, but they should be, you know, in, they should be part of the process in figuring out how to do it. And unfortunately, my own view in some discussions I've had with the Chinese over the last couple of weeks, they're in this position where they're not very proactive. They're not rolling up their sleeves, engaging the new Biden administration, saying, what can we do proactively about North Korea? They're in what they call a wait and see mode. And you know, waiting to see what the Biden administration comes up with and then deciding how they will participate. And I hope that dynamic changes, because I think it will, in addition to, as you talked about, this, you know, this Southern Triangle cooperation, which I think is absolutely critical, US, ROK, Japan, but we're going to have to bring China into this in some sort of constructive way. The strategic competition that we have right now with China doesn't make that easy. So it's going to be hard to sort of sort through. I want to ask one, we've got just a little bit of time left, but I did want to ask one more question about China. I've talked about China. I want to get a sense, Dave, of how you see this. We spent a lot of time at Carnegie Tsinghua Center, obviously, following China's foreign policy, shifting roles in the world, their role on the North Korea issue. You also analyzed the relationship between Chinese and North Korean strategy in 2017 and 2018 in your book. And I want to get a sense from you, you know, how you see China's role to date, but more importantly, that question that you raised about what is China's role in all of this, and how should the Biden team be thinking about bringing China into this process as they go forward?
Yeah, so I think what I've observed by looking at what's happened under Kim Jong-un, and I go back to even 2013, my first case, where I argued that was the first nuclear crisis under Kim. I claimed that even back then, when many people were saying how bad the relationship was, you saw it wasn't Kim Jong-un going to Beijing, but Zhou Yonghui, arguably the number two man, if not now, but maybe back then, went to China in May of 2013, and he met with generals in uniform. And then when he met with Xi Jinping, he had just taken office, and he met him in his party garb, like a Mao suit. So he met him. He met Xi Jinping at the time. So my take was that the relationship, isn't always positive. but you can argue it never was. But there was always this constant, engagement that was going on by and large over the years. Why? I think the North Koreans recognize how important China is. They don't want to be overly dependent on the Chinese. But at the end of the day, we just kind of talked about, you know, what China can do and how they're going to be part of the process. My only argument is what I was trying to say was we cannot depend on the Chinese to exert their influence or pressure to denuclearize North Korea to the point that we'll be satisfied. That's never going to happen. And whether we like it or not, like you said, North Korea and China will ensure that they'll be involved in this process or anything else that might happen on the Korean Peninsula. So, that is clear. China has a lot of leverage on both Koreas. So I don't think that could be discounted. So moving forward, things don't look good with respect to great power competition and how that's ramping up. So what motivation would China have to help us resolve the North Korea nuclear issue? I'm thinking not a lot, right? And many have already said for years how important it is for China to have a stable North Korea. People talk about the buffer state all the time, but they prefer the status quo. You could argue perhaps others in the region want the status quo. And depending who's in power in South Korea, you can debate about what the South Koreans want. Do they really want unification? So that debate is ongoing. So ultimately, it might just come down to what we talked about briefly about the triangles, you know, the balance of power that we saw during the Korean War. You can argue that kind of a framework is another way to kind of examine, you know, all the different relationships, bilateral, multilateral, that exist on the peninsula and in Northeast Asia. So, yes, China will be a player. It's just that I don't think it'll be a key player to get what we want, which is almost close to CBID.
Yeah.
But they're going to, you know, always be there. I don't know if, you know, Kim Jong-un sits in his villa or office and thinks China will always save me. I'm not sure if he thinks that, but there are many reasons why the Chinese would want to keep him in power.
You know, you remind me of one story when I was in North Korea on one trip, and the North Koreans, I traveled there with Sung Kim, who's now been designated as the new North Korean envoy under President Biden. But we were there to convince the North Koreans to give up their nuclear declaration as part of the commitments that they had made. And they were late in doing so. And we had these conversations that dragged out forever. And at one point, just to kind of see what kind of reaction I would get, I said to the North Korean interlocutors, you know, another reason that you need to give up the nuclear declaration is because if you don't, China, as the chair of the six-party talks, will be very upset. And one guy stood up from the other side of the table and pointed his finger at me and said, China is not our big brother, and we don't have to do what China says. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, from a U.S. perspective, China supports North Korea quite a bit. In fact, I would argue it's in many ways North Korea's lifeline. And you see that resentment, and you mentioned it, Dave, you know, they don't want to be too dependent on China, but they are. And that's the reality of it. And so it's a real complicated relationship between North Korea and China. North Korea counts on China to have its back and to support it. But at the same time, it resents that it has as much leverage over it as it does.
Yeah, so this is a good segue to kind of talk about, you know, how North Korea approaches its relationships with China and the U.S. and others. Of course, you know about Juche and, you know, the simple phrase, self-reliance. But I've been reading a book by Donald Emerson from Stanford, The Deer and the Dragon, and it's about China and Southeast Asia. And of course, we're involved as well in the book. But he and the others that write chapters in the book talk about, you know, these deers, these small countries in Southeast Asia wanting strategic autonomy. So people always ask me about this idea of self-reliant, right? North Korea is never self-reliant, they argue, because they take so much from outside, to include the Chinese primarily. So I think it's a better way to describe this idea of strategic autonomy. That's what they want. You could even say progressives in South Korea, that's what they want. Strategic autonomy from the United States. That's why they want the wartime OPCON transition back, which was also mentioned in the joint statement, but it'll be conditions-based. So that means it may not happen by next year. So it could be punted down the road, you know, many more years. So strategic autonomy, I think, is what that guy meant.
Mm.
Right. They're not our big brother, but you can debate about that.
Yeah.
You could also, there's so many things that you could kind of invoke, like the tributary system. But I think strategic autonomy is what many countries like North Korea want.
Yeah.
And I think nuclear ICBMs in part gives them that.
Well, Dave, this has been a fascinating conversation. I could go on for quite some time, but I want to be respectful of your time. I want to encourage our listeners, again, to pick up your new book, Kim Jong-un's Strategy for Survival, A Method to Madness. Where can they buy this, Dave?
You can go to Roman and Littlefield website and buy it, or Amazon.
Or Amazon. You can get anything on Amazon these days. And also go back to Dave's previous book, 2018, also not pretty current, actually. I mean, just 3 years ago. So that book is called Rationality in the North Korean Regime, Understanding the Kim's Strategy of Provocation. Dave, it's been great to talk. Thank you for joining the China and the World podcast. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you for listening to the China and the World podcast. For more episodes and research, please go to carnegiechinghua.org. This episode was produced by Lucas Cheyenne with assistance from Madison Reed, Luke Incarnation, Li Chi Shu, John Ferguson, and Sophia Rosso.